Blog Talk Radio.
Monkey Man by the Rolling Stones, and this is your mother's medicine cabinet, brought to you by those folks over at the Literary Underground. Anyhow, before we get into the guest here in a second, our next show is going to be writer, publisher, and editor Make to Eat, same time. But tonight we have the editor, publisher of Lummox Press, and a writer himself, Artie Armstrong. Artie, are you there? Hey,
yeah,
what's going
I think
on?
So. I was just waiting, hoping that I hadn't blown it by not being in the queue at the right time.
Yeah, usually you just call in the top of the hour.
No, I called early. I got stuck in some weird loop.
Yeah, I saw your thing, but I couldn't do anything about it because it was too early.
Hey, man, every time I see my thing, I can't do anything about it either. So, you know, we're in the same fucking boat, you know what I'm saying?
Right on. So how are things out in Los Angeles today?
Well, I don't know about Los Angeles, but things in Long Beach were kind of nice. The weather's nice, finally, and, you know, all is right with the world, as long as you don't, like, pay attention to too much.
Right on. So let's just get right into it. First, we'll talk a little bit about your press there, and then we'll get into some of your poems.
Okay.
So tell us about, like, going way back in the past, how Lummox Press came all about.
Well, Lummox came about because I was involved with the poetry festival here in Long Beach and in 95. And, well, actually, that's the origin of the Lummox Journal. Sorry, let's go back a little further. 93, I was living in San Pedro. And I started writing poetry again, and I got a pretty nice reception off of what I was doing. And somebody said, "Oh, you gotta have a chapbook, man. Chapbook? What's a chapbook? Well, it's this thing with your poems. It's like a little book." Oh. So I talked to a friend of mine, and she says, "Oh, yeah, well, we can make one." I said, "Oh, okay." So we started making chapbooks of a couple of my little tiny collections, and my friend said, "You know, you got to have like a name for this, you know, like, who's publishing it?" "Well, I'm publishing it, but, you know, you need a name." I said, "Well, I'll just call it the Lummox Press then, because I'm a big Lummox, so why not?" And that's really how Lummox got started, totally to self-publish.
Right on.
And then eventually I started making these little red books that people seemed to really enjoy. And I was also publishing this little magazine called The Lummox Journal, which people seemed to enjoy. And Jerry Lachlan said, "You know, if you're going to be a real press, you got to publish other people." So I started publishing other people, and that's how the thing kind of expanded. And now I'm still publishing other people. I stopped doing the Lummox Journal for 6 years, and now it looks like I'm doing it again. And the only thing that's different is I'm not doing little red books so much, but I am doing, like, trade paperbacks. So, you know.
Cool.
Like a real small press, like a real press, you know. Next, mm-hmm. I'll have to start wearing underwear and a tie, you know.
So, I have one of the old Lummox journals, and
yeah.
And now you've got this, I have some of the old stuff, and now you've got
the new
huge
one.
The monster
the
coming
huge
out next
monster.
Month.
Yeah.
So is that how you're going to do it from now on, just one issue a year as opposed to all the smaller
I
ones?
I think so. I think because the small ones were, like, you know, they came out monthly, and that's a pretty hefty publishing schedule to have to work with, even if you're talking about some little magazine with only 150 subscribers, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I basically had very little social life during the time of that was coming out, because everything I did had to be planned within the first couple weeks of each month. So the trips that I wanted to take had to be, you know, I had to be back by the 15th so I could get to work on the next issue.
And
this, and
that
way,
must have been a lot of submissions you had to sift through,
lots of submissions, yeah. And, you know, and then I had to come up with, you know, I tried to be about two or three interviews ahead so I could always have an interview handy to plug in, and, you know, I'd get essays and I'd write essays, and, you know, after a while it got kind of difficult to keep coming up with something new, you know. Yeah. And I always thought, oh, I'll do this until I don't have any more subscribers, because it was basically a subscriber-based thing. And I finally ran out of steam. So my subscribers were like, no, man, we want another year for it. I'm like, I can't. I can't do it. You're killing me. So I stopped. And now this way, an annual, I have plenty of time to, you know, dither myself away, and then eventually, like when it gets down to the wire, I have to start, you know, go back, mad rush, crazy, oh, what am I going to do this? How am I going to do this interview? Or I can actually stretch it out over almost a year and, you know, do it that way, which is what I'm hoping I will do. So
that's cool.
Although
so,
I have to say the pressure on the last of this first issue, the pressure on the for the last 3 months or so has been pretty intense.
Do you do all that? Do you do all the sifting through the submissions yourself? Everything is done yourself?
I was going to do that, and then somebody said, you know, maybe you ought to consider guest editors. And then they told me what a guest editor did, and I thought, well, you know, that would help. Have somebody else help me, you know? So I came up with this crazy idea of getting people, like poets that I knew from around the country, and even also I had asked some people that I knew in Europe and the person I knew in Africa and, you know, other places, to assemble a group of poets, solicit, you know, X amount of poems from them, and then break it down to like one or two poems per poet, put the whole thing together, write an essay as to why you thought that they're, you know, why is this group of poets any more important than anybody, any other group of poets, or why did you choose them over other people you might have chosen? And it did help, but the only problem is I thought I sent out like 15 invitations thinking maybe I might get 8, you know, that would be interested. And I got 14.
Damn.
14 times 10 is 140 times 2 is 280 poems. That's the friggin' book. That's the issue right there. Fortunately, we cut them down to like one poem apiece for most of the groups. And a few people dropped out, so it wasn't quite so daunting. But it was still like a group of the 11 or 12. So it still was a huge amount of a large amount of poetry.
Right on.
So I only had to work with the remaining, you know, 200 or 300 submissions that came in from individual poets.
And when does this book comes out next month, doesn't it?
Well, the official release is mid-November, but I've already got copies of it, and I'm mailing them out to the poets that contributed to my little I had a little deal going where if you were in the book and you bought a copy for $20, you get 2 copies, plus you'd get a free 8th-page ad if you wanted to use it. And it's kind of a pre-publication thing. You know, because it's going to cost me... Well, it cost me about $10 per book to send them out. Between printing and shipping. And, you know, I get them printed somewhere else. They ship them to me, so that's a factor. And then the cost of shipping them out. I'm spending about $10 on a book, you know, just to get it to somebody. And in my opinion, I think, and I know this, and this is probably not I know it's not the standard rule, and I know a number of people were put off by it, but in my opinion, it's about time that the poets started kicking in a little something on these productions that I put out. You know?
Well, I don't know. 2 copies and an 8-page ad for $20 don't sound bad. I'm in that book. I'm about to...
Considering that the book retails for $30, So it's like a $10 savings. Well, it's more than that. It's a $20 savings if you count the two books for the price of one. Yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
that,
it's a great deal. And, you know, I was hoping maybe I'd get like half of the poets that were involved, so I might get like 100 people to go for it. I got about 75, which is not bad. You know, it's not bad. It's not as much as I would have liked. And, I mean, it would have liked, would be great if like everybody would have jumped on board, but a lot of people said no. No, I don't think so. So I gave
the offer of
a PDF file, you know, in lieu of a hard copy. And
oh, no, I'm thinking of wanting to get involved with that. I don't think it's such a bad deal. Two books in the eight-page fold-out for $20. I mean, not only am I, like, in it, but I'm getting all the other artwork, art from the other people. I don't think it's such a bad idea. So everybody out there should chip in. But so let's go on to the books.
I just got to say, at this point, you know, that deal has closed. So it was kind of a special to just do for, you know, certain people. And, you know, it basically ended on October 1st. So, that you know, but still, I'll sell it to you for, you know, $5 off, and that includes shipping. So actually, pretty good deal. It's 236 pages in an 8x10 with, like, over 200 people in it. It ain't a bad deal. I'm just concerned that people are going to think, wow, that's an awful lot of money to pay for a poetry book.
But, and speaking of the poetry books, you've published, I've got some of your books here. I've got, like, one of yours and Todd Moore and Jason Hardung's, and they're pretty good quality. So, are you going anywhere in the future with these books? Are you doing more? Is that all you're doing?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm doing more. I mean, I put this magazine out. You know, the reason here's what happened. I was getting frustrated because I don't know how many publishers you get on your program, but I don't really have any contact with anybody else, so I don't know how it is with the rest of the small press world. But in my experience, it's been really slow lately, and I put out a number of books this year that I thought would have a better, you know, would take off better. And the writers assured me that, you know, oh yeah, man, I'm going to really push this, and I've got all these readings set up, and you know, we're going to get the word out. And I'm like, okay, great. You work on your end, I'll work on mine. And those books, pretty much every book, tanked. You know, because the authors just like something happened, and they're like, "Well, I got my books. I guess I'm done." You know, and so I was frustrated, and I thought, "Well, how can I generate more income? Because I'm basically relying on the books that I sell as my primary income at this time, which is crazy. But you know, I live a very Spartan life, so that I can do it." I mean, poets are supposed to live Spartan lives, but not publishers. We're all supposed to be fat cats smoking cigars and eating caviar, right? It ain't so, let me tell you. So I decided, what I need to do is I need to start doing the Lubbock again, you know? And that was my crazy solution to my thing. And you know, the potential is here. It is a nice-looking book. You calling it a book, it's actually a magazine. It had been a book form because it's so big in this particular format. 8x10, you know. It looks good. I'm looking at it right now. And I'll probably read, I'd like to read some poems out of this before we get into some of my own stuff, if that's okay.
Well, go for it. Why don't you shoot us one or two of them right now?
Okay. Well, let's see here. It's such a wide variety of choices. There's, like, groups from all over the country. There's a group from Nigeria. Well, here's one of my favorite guys. I was so happy that he actually got involved with the project, because a lot of people that I invited did not get back to me. So it's like there's a lot of new faces to me in this collection. This is William Taylor. You know William Taylor, right?
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah, Bill Taylor, yeah, San Francisco. Yeah, I published a book for him back in 98, I think, or 99, I'm not sure which it was. called Any Abyss Will Do, and I always loved that collection, and I guess Bill thought it was one of his favorites too. So here's one by Bill Taylor called Here With the Rest of Them. It's at the corner of Turk and Taylor. Maybe you know it. I was going to say the saddest bar in town, but it's a place beyond sorrow. A netherworld of the lost, a waiting room for the void. The junkie next to me is way far gone and stares with abandoned eyes at the television screen. She laughs an empty laugh and says, "Hey, you want to do some heroin?" I say, "No thanks, I've got a beer." And she says, "Oh, I thought you looked like the type." I shrug and I smile and guess maybe I do, because I'm here with the rest of them, here on a Wednesday afternoon in this place where life is turned away at the door and death just can't be bothered.
Night.
Bill Taylor.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure when I had him on my show, I think he read that one. Or I read with him in San Francisco in July. Maybe he read it then.
Funny, I think it's one he reads pretty regularly, and I see why. I mean, it's a great poem.
Oh, yeah, his books are, I have some of his books, and they're great.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this, so why don't you give us another one?
Okay. And just as in response to your question of earlier, I actually am hoping to do a collection of Bill's poetry sometime, maybe next year or the year, or the in 2014.
Excellent.
Okay. Here's one by B.C. Petrakos called In Part. The part of me that is missing was funny, quick-witted, open-minded, laughed, and believed. The part of me that is missing was hopeful, honest, kind, that piece, taken in midnight's violent stupidity by selfish strangers, scoring the road in blood-drenched escape route, taken in silence, lonely howl. That piece waits for me with lions and lambs, explains mysteries, says, "Look again, the clock is not king, the pain a new door, open it at risk, always at risk."
Right. Who was that?
B.C. Petrakos.
Oh, okay.
She lived in West L.A.
Cool. So is this, shifting gears a little bit, a few months back you put out the, or a little further back, you put out the Last Call collection.
Yeah, that was that December.
Are you going to start doing that every few years, or is that just something you just wanted to
Well, I had put out Last Call prior to that, another book, which was called, I think it was Last Call, The Bukowski Legacy. And so I finally ran out of copies. The company of the Bukowski Society of Germany ordered a set of like about 40 copies of that particular book, and that pretty much cleaned out the remainder of, I mean, I've got a couple of copies that I'm hanging on to, but, you know. But,
they ordered those, and you have a bunch of the, because I'm in there, and a bunch of other people are in there, so we're all sitting in Germany somewhere. Is that what yours?
Well, there's a group called the Bukowski Society of Germany.
Okay.
And they ordered 40 copies of the original Last Call. And that essentially was the end of the printing, so it was officially out of print at that point. And I thought, well, yeah, but I got other stuff. I don't want that to be the end of the Last Call legacy. So I did another one, a revised version, and now the new one is Last Call: The Bukowski Legacy Continues, which allows me to put people that I couldn't get before into another collection, and it's not a collection of the work of Charles Bukowski. It's a collection, of people who I feel are sort of carrying on the Bukowski legacy, which is a different kind
well,
of a
yeah,
different take.
I have a few of those books, and it's got the whole explanation, you know. And I don't think it's anybody ripping off him off in any way. I know exactly what you're talking about.
You'd be surprised how many people get disappointed when they find out there's no Bukowski in Last Call. Like they're expecting it to be like Bukowski, right? It's kind of like the anthology I did when Todd Moore passed away. You know, I wanted to put some of Todd's poetry in there, but let's just say that I was advised that it would be not a good idea and that I would be taken to court if I did. So I have an anthology that talks a lot, that, you know, has a lot of people talking about Todd Moore or writing poetry about Todd Moore, and there's only one piece of Todd Moore poetry in there because I sort of snuck it in as a review. So if somebody wanted to know about Todd Moore, they wouldn't find out about it by reading that anthology. You know, it's kind of weird.
Now, that book of his, I think it's that I've got of yours, The Wooden Gun.
The Riddle of the Wooden Gun, yeah.
Yeah, that was sort of, because myself, I was caught up in like a language-y area of my life for 2 years, and then I read that, and it seemed to like change my perspective back to what it was. It's just like an excellent book, and you've got like some really like good writers, and I don't think it's just you that like. That has like tanked with some of your books lately. I know that like some other people are going through the thing, and that brings up the question: like, is it like, is there anybody outside of the writers of poetry who actually like poetry? I mean, what's your view on that? Being involved in it 20 years.
Well, I try to market to the people that are fans of the particular poet that I publish, or fans of the particular poets. There are a lot of people that like seem to like the Last Call idea, but you know, again, it's kind of embarrassing to me. Although somebody told me a few months ago that I shouldn't worry about it because there's not a whole lot of sales in small press, but it's embarrassing to me that Lummox Press has almost no books that have sold over 100 copies, at least in these particular trade paperback editions. And that, it boggles my mind. Like, how is that possible? But,
yeah,
you know, it is what it is. So I started referring to Lummox as a micro press, which means, you know, we publish print runs that are less than 100 books, because we have sales that are less than 100 books. And as soon as I did that, I pre-sold the Lummox magazine to the tune of about 110 copies. I mean, the book's not even officially out, and I've already sold over 100 copies. So now I'm no longer a micro press, now I'm back into being a small press. And hopefully this magazine will maybe broaden the audience to the Lummox catalog. I don't know if it will or not, but in answer to your question, poets do not tend to be good consumers unless they have money, and most poets in the small press tend to not have much money. So,
well, a lot of times you have to like stick to the writers that you like, and I mean, I find them on with Lummox or Epic Rights or my own publisher Neoplasis or this new one that Razor's got going on over there. I mean, there's some like good writers on there, but I think it's like the general public, you know, they don't.
Well, the thing of it is though, there are so many poets in the you want to call it the general public sector. I mean, these days, I pick up a magazine or I pick up a like an anthology of some sort or collection, you know, and I look at the names involved, and I rarely recognize anybody I know. And I know a lot of poets. But the poets that I know are the poets that I met when I was doing the Lummix Journal, so that's like 10 years to 6 years back, you know? And there's a whole lot, a whole new crop of potential, you know, of potential audience and potential consumer out there. It's just, the trick is you just got to figure out a way to get to them. And I'm hoping by doing this magazine that I'll be able to reach a broader audience because, you know, I got over 200 people in here. That's way more than I could ever do when I was doing the Lummix Journal. Yeah, it's like four or five times. Yeah, so the potential is there. It's just a question of, you know, it's always, it's the same old thing. It's marketing. And no matter how, I mean, I market by word of mouth mostly and, you know, other things. I mean, I do it the old-fashioned way. You know, I get out there and I beat the boards and I sell the books one book at a time. And that's what I encourage my writers to do, but they don't always follow through. So,
as you mentioned earlier, you said the some of the poets aren't or writers aren't living up to their end. But like for example, like myself, that first book I had like came out like 2 or 3 years ago. I had to go out there. I had to like spend money in order to get my name out there, you know. And it's part like these, they don't hustle, you know. And and I got a book coming out next month, and I'm going to have to hustle the shit out of it. Like, it's just as much my end as it is the publisher,
I think. It's actually, it's more your end than the publisher's. Because it's your book.
Well,
you have a vested interest. You should have a vested interest.
I mean,
used to think it was like maybe a 60-40 split, you know? And now it's like almost an 80-20 split. Because I've got, at the moment, well, this is my 31st publication in this particular series. You know, I started 4 years ago, and I got, you know, I'm up to 31 books, and which means that, you know, I have about 45 minutes a day. If it's a 24-hour day, I've probably got 40 minutes a day per title to like focus on. And I tell people, I say, look, you know, here's how it works. It's the old adage, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. You know, if your book's selling, I'll put more time and energy into pushing it. If your book's not selling, I'll be looking at somebody else's project to push. You know?
Well, yeah.
And,
I mean,
and some people get that and some people don't. And unfortunately, I haven't figured out a way to, like, weed people out in the beginning to tell if they're going to actually follow through on their promises or if they're going to say, oh, yeah, I'll do that. And then, of course, you know, they walk out and they forget, you know.
Well, they don't get creative. They don't, like, hop on trains and buses instead of planes. They don't sleep on couches instead of hotels. You know, you got to get creative to get yourself out there and around there, you know. So, I don't know.
Yeah,
but anyways,
well,
we're down.
Unfortunately, I've had a string of people that I published that I thought were, well, they were really good. I mean, all the people I published are really good writers, don't get me wrong. They just don't always know how to promote. And some of them can't do it because they're not really capable of getting out into the world and promoting, you know, which I don't know. I mean, if I knew that, I might not be inclined to publish them because I'm in a position that really requires me to rely on the writer to help promote the book. And if they don't do that, well, but there's not really any, I mean, you know, there's no way to know until you get down to the wire and then you're kind of left there holding a bag of something in your hand and wondering where did everybody go, you know? So anyway.
But we're down to 25, 30 minutes here, so you want to get into your stuff now here.
Okay, better get into the real stuff, the real nitty gritty.
So, we're just gonna start with like the annoying question for, because we got some listeners out there. And by the way, listeners, if you'd like to call in and ask RD a question, feel free to do so. So how did your interest in poetry come about? Was it a young thing, or did it come later in life?
Oh, yeah. You know, I started writing poetry when I was in high school, I think. Probably. I mean, something like real poetry as opposed to, like, joke poetry, which I probably wrote in elementary or, like, junior high. And I wrote some really bad, bad stuff that will probably, even if I could find it, I don't think I would ever share it with anybody. And then I wrote poetry through my 20s and into my 30s, and I kind of didn't really have a nervous breakdown, but I kind of had got myself into a situation where I didn't trust anything that I wrote down on paper, and I stopped writing for like 10 years. And then in my early 40s, when I was living in San Pedro, I started writing again. That was when I talked about 93 or so. And it's like the voice that I wrote in had sort of matured, you know, in those 10 years. And, you know, like a fine wine or Corinthian leather or something like that, you know. And I was actually writing pretty decent poetry, and that's what leads me to where I am now. It's been almost 20 years since I started writing again, and you know, I didn't mean to fall into this publishing racket. It was mostly just to get my own stuff out there because I didn't like the way that other people treated me. That's the reason I started the magazine, was because I didn't like the way that I was being treated in other small press magazines, you know. So I said, well, I'll just do it myself. So then, and here I am.
Were you part of that, or not part of it, but connected to all that in the Los Angeles, like S.A. Griffin and all those Venice Beach type poets? Were you like
no,
part of that crowd?
No.
Or?
Well, I mean, I know them. I know them, but no, I've always been kind of on the outside.
Okay.
Like I feel like a real outsider, you know. I even try to get into some of these groups down here in Long Beach or the Orange County, or you know, there's like all these cliques in Los Angeles, you know, there's all these different groups. I've tried to fit in all over the place, but I just never found any place that felt like home, and I guess I just step on way too many toes to be included in other groups, or I'm too much of a, you know, it's not my way or the highway, but, you know, I know who I am and I'm not going to be pushed around kind of mentality that, you know, when you're trying to fit into a clique, that doesn't always go down well, you know. So,
well,
yeah, I'm pretty much a loner.
Yeah, I understand that. I totally agree. I'd rather know people from all over than stick around a group. But, yeah, so anyways, I've got your book, also the title escapes me, is Fire and Rain.
Yeah, which one, Volume 1 or Volume 2?
I think Volume 1.
Okay, Volume 1's got the light cover, and Volume 2's got the slightly darker cover.
Yeah, I read it, I got it about over a year ago. It's,
yeah.
I can't see it from here, but
it don't matter. Fire
2's
got kind of a dark blue, and Fire 1's like a sort of a gray-colored spine. That's
I've got thousands of books over here. I'm not going to be able to see it. It'd probably take me a half an hour the rest of the show to find it.
All right, that's cool. I got both copies right here.
I was kind of just going to set that up, being like an excellent book,
sure.
And I enjoyed it very much. And when I was in L.A. 2 years ago, I got to read with you at the that bookstore,
right.
in Echo Park, yeah. And after I heard you read, I think that's when I, a month or two after I had gotten home, I had bought that book, and I really have gotten into your writing. So anything throughout the years, any book, why don't you give us about two poems in a row so I can rest my voice here from talking.
Sure, man. Hey, no problem. This is one that I hardly ever read, but I figured what the hell. This is from Fire and Rain, Volume 2. And the premise is, the selected poems, 1993 to 2007, So this volume two kind of covers from about 2000 to 2007. Volume one covers from 93 to 2000. So this is actually in the back of the book. So it must be towards the end of that cycle. It's called Birds at Midnight. It's weird stumbling home early spring, late night. Long Beach and birds are riffing, a midnight jam, chorus, answering soloist. Quite amazing, and yet, not really. What's going on here? Birds on 9th Street seem to be calling out to birds on Lime Avenue at the intersection. It's mostly flutes with the occasional bass riff by the dog on the corner. Traffic provides a modified James Brown horn section, but it's discreet, you know? Well played, but sub-zero, blending, passing, subtle, something the birds can hang their riffs on. A wall of sound that they hang their art on their songs, you know? I try to figure out what could cause all this ruckus. Perhaps they are mourning the pigeon I saw laying dead a few days ago, now squashed flat by a caravan of cars. But no, their songs are too happy. So perhaps they are celebrating. Better that grubby old pigeon than them, right? Better that yellow tanager. I saw it on Cherry. Is this the avian flu coming home to roost? Or maybe it's just the West Nile virus back for another season. Either way, it's beginning to look like our days are numbered, like some old calendar montage where the days flip by as if there's no tomorrow. And what if we are the endangered ones? What then? Will Walmart save us or Al Gore? Whatever is going on, I pause for a moment to savor the exchange between bird and machine and fish the keys out of my pocket.
Nice, man. Wait, we've got a caller. Someone wants to ask you a question before you get into another poem.
Okie dokie.
Yeah, you're on there.
You know, that was fucking excellent, man. I love it when you deliver that line.
Gee, I wonder who this is.
Well, you know, everyone in Canada, they begin their shows with a cock joke. Then they talk about walking the dog.
Well,
and you did, man. You lasted 18 seconds, and you turned it all back to your cock. I love it.
Hey, I'm all about my cock.
You know, my friend, I would love to hear you read that cricket poem.
The cricket poem, okay. I think that's in the first volume here. Let me see if I can find it.
That's my question, anyway.
Okay, that's your question? That's not a question. These fucking Canadians, man, they don't even know what a question is. What the hell?
Well, we blame it on the French, and so do you. Hey,
okay.
Frank, I love it, man. I just, these conversations like these are golden, man. This has been a great show. You guys are, you know, killing birds, and I love it.
Thank you.
Oh, we don't want to kill birds, man. We want to, you know, because I love birds. Birds are way cool. But the problem
well,
is,
you
I can't
the thing
there,
is, man,
there
I,
it is.
As, you got
I
it?
I found it. Yeah,
all right.
I got it. You know, I want to please my public. You know.
You got to give us the backstory, though, man.
The backstory?
Yeah.
Here's the backstory. When a firefighter is immobile for a certain length of time, an alarm that is sewn into his coat is activated. This alarm sounds like a high-pitched warbling. On September 11, 2001, the air around the World Trade Center collapse was filled for a time with this sound as hundreds of firefighters were buried under debris. Okay?
Wow.
Here's the poem. Yeah, we'll let the dust settle on that one for a little bit.
Yeah, that's like a shot to the gut.
Yeah, so now here's the poem. Something about crickets. After the world got suddenly old and Manhattan pulled this gray blanket tightly to its neck, the air filled with an odd sound, a warbling of sorts, as if a fleet of tiny alarms had gone off simultaneously. Don't these crickets know that it's not yet nightfall? Why can't they just get up and dust themselves off and fly home to their families?
Damn, dude.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's brutal. I love it.
Hey,
now that I've lightened the mood, I can safely continue. You know, I got to tell you, Frank, this station, man, cuts me out all the time. Like, I was looking, it says, okay, there's 47 minutes. Then it says there's 24 days and, like, 1 second remaining. Then it, like, gives me sound bites in, like, 14 seconds. So here I am. I had to phone in, and thank you.
Okay. I'll have the mechanic look into it.
I wouldn't take it personally, man.
Well, I don't know, man. Here in Canada, things are always screwy, so.
It's because you're on
credit. All right, and you know, RD, I got to tell you, man, when it comes to you, man, you're such an interesting character, and it's so good talking to you, but sometimes, man, you just got to let the bombs fly and start reading. You know what I'm saying? I would love to hear the poem will save you, and then read everything you plan to read tonight. And I'm going to listen in, man. Great
well,
show, boys.
I don't think there's enough time for me to read everything I plan to read. We have to do a second show. Because I am old Mike Hoare from way back.
No, there's always time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't know, Frank, what do we got?
Well, of airtime, we got 13 minutes, and then we can go a little while into overtime, about 15 minutes, so we got about a half hour.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
We can just go until the lady cuts us up.
It's your call, man. It's your call.
I ain't doing shit up here in North Dakota. If it's just like
Well, there you go, man. We have 30 uninterrupted minutes for Artie to drop some bombs, man. You know, it was a pleasure having you on the Thin Edge because you dropped bomb after bomb after bomb. It was beautiful.
Yes, it was a special night, I tell you.
All right, so deliver the goods, my friend.
Okay, I'm delivering goods now. All right, this is called Lucid Thought Number 3, another poem that I don't read very often. I don't even know how this poem is going to end up, actually. It's two poems within a poem. It's kind of like a process poem, okay? Today, while I was cutting in the stucco trim with a second coat of enamel, I had a great idea for a poem. But since I was up on a ladder and with nothing to take notes on, hey, it wasn't my wall, I was forced to try and remember it later. This is me trying to remember it later, without much luck. And I'm struggling now to pull that fragment out of the swirling mess that is my brain, and all I get is the fact that you are 21 hours away from me, and one of the stars in the constellation called the Big Dipper is actually a galaxy, and something about how the full moon on the winter solstice this year will be closest to the Earth in years and will exert an extra amount of pull on those of us who are inclined towards lunacy. And I realize that the poem is forming anyway, and it's not going to be that great one I had glimpsed today, but couldn't capture. Instead, it would be this one. 21 hours away, and my head is as clogged as a broken sewer line. My ideas are being forced to back up on each other, blending and losing their individuality like stars in a galaxy glimpsed from far away. 21 hours away, and there is a star missing from my favorite constellation. I don't know if it has anything to do with you, but the romantic in me would like to think that it does. So I listen to that romantic part and wonder if it might be true. I mean about the star. I guess I am the muddled old motherfucker you always suspected I was, after all.
Mm.
Love it.
Yeah, why don't you give us another one right away?
Huh? Okay. Well, here they come.
All right.
Here they come. I've already got them. I got some marked. Okay. I think I might have read this one on Wolf's show. I'm not sure. It's called Eyes Like Mingus. Mingus, for anybody that doesn't know, and shame on you for not knowing, is the Charles Mingus, the bass, the jazz bass player, who died from ALS, which is also called Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a disease of the nervous system where the nerves die and you slowly become like trapped in your own body. It's a terrible
I think that happened to my cock about 5 years ago.
Yeah, really? You're
right. You know what?
You know,
I think it's true.
I think what happened was actually it was the other way around.
Yeah, well, you never know. You know, I'm still trying to wrap
my brain around going.
Go,
man.
All I know is okay. I walk the dog out of necessity now. You know, not because I want to or fucking am inclined to do, or I like taking a 20-minute shower.
Try tying a leash around your car and then walking the dog that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might find
it. Note to self.
Hold it nice. Whole new experience.
All right, my friend, eyes like Mingus.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that we're letting Frank rest his voice now. I think Frank's like probably stepped out to the local bar for a quick nip.
No, I'm here, man. Just keep rattling them off like a machine gun, one after another.
All right,
absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, I ain't Todd Moore, for God's sake. Eyes like Mingus. Eyes like Flint. Like flecks of coal. Like shiny bits of starless sky trapped in the ruins of a slag heap. Eyes like bolts of steel. Sullen and angry. Piercing. A bullet finding its mark. Like a jaguar, passionate and alive, yet hating the trap. Pacing behind the bars, bars like a skeleton trapped inside the mind behind. Eyes like Mingus, like notes caught in the net, like the grid of notation, like Mingus in shamanic Mexico, trapped in a chair. No strength to grip, no fingers to coat notes with, no feet to stand up and count with, no time, no signature. Eyes like concrete, shattering. Like glass splintering, like the wrecking ball slap, like voltage unregulated, like a passion laid bare to the gallery's scrutiny, like a madman's frothing nightmare, like the inexplicable accuracy of random fate, like a shot to the gut, like Coltrane's favorite things, like your fingers stilled. Eyes like an empty glass staring bug-eyed into space, upturned and dispassionate, like a dream lost in the stars. Eyes like Mingus, silent, but never silenced.
Nice, man. Before you rattle off another one that's going to blow my hair back, whatever hair I have left, but why don't you tell all the people that won't be able to hear in the after show, or the last after 15 minutes, how they can get your books or any books that they might want to check
sure.
out.
Absolutely. They can go to www.lummoxpress, that's LUMMOXPRESS.com, and just click on the Lummox Press catalog. There's a link right on the front cover. And it'll take you to the catalog and just start scrolling. And you'll scroll down, you'll see all these different titles, and towards the bottom, you'll find my stuff. I haven't done anything particularly new in a while. And, that's true. I put out four
you
books.
You know, no, man. No, you know what? If you guys, anyone listening to Your Mother's Medicine Cabinet with Frank Reardon tonight, Artie lays it down fucking straight and true like fucking bombs. Get this man's books, man. I got to tell you, Fire and Rain, Volumes 1 and 2, El Penango and Other Twisted Tales. How do you say that?
El Pagano.
And Twisted Tales. I'm telling you something. If you're missing out on Artie Armstrong, man, you're just not paying attention. You know, and that's the thing. You're so you want to promote the press and the press and the press, but you know what? Your books, man. That's what it's about tonight, anyway, and every night, really. You know.
Well, that's true. But my books are intrinsically involved with the press because I am both.
Well, this is true. I mean, absolutely true.
And I am also an empire. Very skeptical.
All right. Well, you know what? If you want Rain Dog's books, man, go to LummoxPress.com. And I'm telling you, buy Fire and Rain, Volumes 1 and 2, you know?
You won't be disappointed.
All right, my friend, drop another bomb. Pull one from those books and just take us home, man.
Well, here's one called Denise. She dances naked except for a red blanket, which she holds in her arms like a partner. She tangos around the room, her left arm high, her right hand low, flipping the red hem back and forth. Much the way flamenco dancers flirt with the crowd, showing an ankle, a calf, maybe even a thigh. She is showing me more. Her pale skin like butter melting, muscles rippling beneath the red blanket, a flag draped limply on a windless day, the air in her studio apartment too dense to breathe deeply. A shape of sunlight creeps up my leg, warming as it progresses. I lay on her bed, at one with this day, at peace with the world, at least for a while, at least till this dance is over.
Nice, man. Yeah, I like, really, really got into your writing, like, after that time I read with you in Echo Park. I don't remember a lot of the other people. I remember Doug and... Well, there was that guy from, like, Czechoslovakia that was, like,
right,
making
Chris.
Weird noises and stuff.
He was a strange one. He was. I got it, man. But I like that. I like people that do weird shit like that, you know?
But I wanted to tell the listeners that it was that reading that made me go and buy your books, and I was completely not disappointed whatsoever, though I will admit I did get them off of Amazon, but I guess you get something out of that, don't you?
Cool, I get a little something. Yeah,
Rain Dog, I'm telling you, man, you distribute through me, man, you get lots off Amazon. Fuck, I've solved the riddle, man. Get off the Death Star.
Yeah.
Tell you, man, you know what? If you would do it for me, man, the poem will save you.
Well, okay, let me see if I can find it. Oh, there it is.
If you do it, man, and then go right into your next selection, man, I swear it'll be fucking beautiful. Because something happens to you when you read that poem, man, and you just fucking, the years fall off like dust. It's just fucking gorgeous, man.
Yeah, like he says. I should just dress you in a little cheerleader outfit and get some pom-poms, and you could just follow
me
around.
I'll do it, man. I'll do it. I'll wear my wife's panties. You know I will, man.
Oh, yeah.
We're moving into
a whole new realm here, you know.
That's right. Well, hey, man, this ain't your mother's press. Lum Express ain't your mother's press, so you know what, man.
It ain't my mother's medicine, and it certainly ain't my mother's closet either, for that matter.
You go. See?
I
have a steam point.
It, you know? All right. The poem will save you. Starts with a quote from Charles Bukowski, which is actually a line from one of his poems, and I don't remember which poem it's called. It says, "Even their nightmares are ringed with tinsel." It's the middle of May, and a warm tropical rain is falling, turning dusty streets into greasy ones. I'm reading the newest book of poetry from my favorite now-dead poet. Marveling at its clarity and the strength of his lines, he said it. The poem will save your ass from madness. The poem will save you while fat drops of acid rain descend, while the bills pile up, while the paint peels, while you wait and wait and wait for something to change. It doesn't matter what it is as long as it's something. The poem will save you while your auto insurance climbs, while the phone screams your name, while the pipe calls to you from the other room, while your heart considers the pros and cons of retirement, while the babies scream for attention, while your mind begins to go, while lovers dream of each other, while you dream of becoming someone else, while hookers hook and junkies junk, and the stoner gets steadily dimmer, while the whole country flatlines from a bad batch of crystal, while the beer goes flat, while the women come and go, while you jerk into the hollow memories of their grief laughter, while someone lets the air out of your tires and the wind out of your sails and the joy out of your days, while the life seeps out of your windows and each breath takes you farther from life and closer into death's spinal orbit, while the warranty on your VCR runs out, while the internet sucks you dry, while the open grave waits patiently and the orange waits to be peeled, and the lights flicker and the ground moves and the really important stories wait to be sold, and the needle crawls across the floor at 3 a.m. like an inchworm, while you wait for its promise of happy stupidity, while you binge on lollipop dreams of power and glory, while they plot the next turn in your life, while the streets are overrun with anger and revenge, while you grab as much of the pie as you can carry, while the 911 call goes unanswered, while the oven begins to look really, really inviting, while you place a razor blade on your tongue and swallow, while you eat all the right food groups and still get cancer, while you starve to death on a diet of empty promises, stillborn dreams, and low-fat hopes, the poem will save you.
Fuck, man. Yeah, you read that where it does take you over, like Wolf just said a few minutes back. That was that's intense, dude.
It's hard not to get a little bit emotional.
You know, and thank you, my friend. That was awesome. Yeah, absolutely. And you know what, man? As you know, Frank said, just go into your next one, man. That was gorgeous.
Yeah, well, we're in recorded time now, so
okay.
All you can get
That's great.
In 10 minutes.
All right, I'm going. This is called. This is a short one. It's called Time. Something to do while it's doing you. Next poem. I complain. I say I'm thinking. Man, they feel like it's a short poem. I guess they don't understand the concept. All right. This is from Eeyore, Living Amongst the Mangle, which is my last book, which came out in 2010.
I'll do it in a minute, TV. I swear I will.
It's called Captain. This is called Captain Kickstand. On a good day, he dreams of dancing beneath the starry sky with one hand waving free, pirouetting across the dewy grass with a couple of hippie chicks stoned on acid. But on bad days, he curses the war and the minefield that left him with only fleeting dreams.
Nice, dude.
I love it.
Captain kicks in.
All right, man.
Real guy. Met him in San Pedro.
You know, I gotta say, man, my friend, and I'll say this to you. You know, when I think of Artie Armstrong, I don't necessarily go straight to Lum Express, like, oh well, he's a publisher. But, you know, when I have you on a show or when you're live on the air, when you're actually interacting with people, man, it's you. It's just you, and you're right, you are Lum Express, but you're not Lum Express, you're also this other entity which is these books. And
so
these
I'm Rain Dog.
Yeah, you're Rain Dog, exactly.
I'm Rain Dog. When I'm not Lum Express, which means I'm not RD, I'm Rain Dog, the kinder, gentler, more easy living kind of, easy listening kind of version of me.
Exactly. You know, when I was on your mother's medicine cabinet, and Frank, you know this, right? It was like, we were going to go on, we were going to talk about my book, but instead, we went straight publishing, right? Because, I mean, it was like, it's just such a fascinating riddle for anyone to crack. And I mean, if you crack the riddle, you're the fucking genius, you know what I mean? So,
and you are the genius, Wolf.
Thank you. I'm a madman, but when you know what? If you give the madman control, and next thing you know, arrests are made.
Okay, can I read another poem?
Yeah.
Or are we gonna turn this into the Wolf Carson's hour?
No, go.
This is also from Eeyore, Living Amongst the Mangle. It's called Handicap Zone. Lying in bed, the ward almost quiet, only the beeping of IV monitors and the murmur of a distant TV. I'm awakened by the night nurse, her hand on my shoulder, gently shaking me loose from the cobwebs. What is your pain, Mr. Armstrong? She asks. 7, I reply. Not knowing if 7 is the correct answer, I'm not in a lot of pain, but I came here in pain, so pain is the foundation on which my house has been built, and I must translate that pain from metaphorical to numerical to satisfy the nurse. My system started at 5. 5 is unpleasant. 6 is annoying. 7, exasperating. 8, scary. 9, searing. 10 is blinding, nauseating, and merciful blacking out time. And 11, well, you don't want to know, much less be in the same room with 11. There is no 11, Mr. Armstrong. Well, you know what I mean, nurse. There was an 11 once when Doc C was cleaning out my knee after draining what seemed like a pint of fluid from it. It wasn't painful, but the concept was horrendous. He was poking his finger in all the crevices of my knee joint, like he was looking for change in an old sofa, to clean out any residual guck that was left behind by the infection. I thought my head was going to blow off and shoot around the ward like a deflating balloon, but it didn't. Even a few nights before that, when I had a fever of 103 and my knee felt like it was boiling, I told the nurse that it was a 9 with glimmerings of 14, but she was quick to remind me, there is no 14, Mr. Armstrong. Eventually, I played the game their way, though it wasn't always easy translating from imagery to a 5 to 10 scale. Once they learned I wrote poetry, they gave me a little slack. They knew I was handicapped. You can write a serious poem and still have a little bit of humor, you know, just to kind of like take the edge off.
Absolutely.
You know,
I have to say that I started writing this way because I spent most of my life reading Bukowski. In my opinion, good poems, the ones that I really liked by Bukowski, inevitably seem to have a little punchline at the end of them.
Well, when I was talking to John Yamris on the show sometime in August, we were talking about how, and I totally agree with this, that a lot of times you take yourself a little bit too serious, and it's nice to have humor sometimes in writing, because especially poetry.
I think it's important because a lot of what you were dealing with is not always like, you know, unicorns and rainbows, you know? I mean, poetry deals with a lot of heavy subject matter, and so I think it's essential to have a little perspective, and generally you get perspective when you throw in a little humor. Now, writing poems that are really clever and really cute and just totally tongue-in-cheek, I'm not particularly keen on that either, you know? But in life, there's always a little bit of an ironic twist, you know? Especially if you got kind of a sick perspective like Wolf and me. You need to be able to laugh at yourself, and you need to be able to laugh at the situation. Otherwise, you'd go crazy.
Exactly. So you said that, I don't know if I read this on your Lummix, not the website, but like your Facebook page or... recently that you said something that you were going to do a collection of short stories or poems or something that had to do with your continuous trips to the ER? Is that
Well, I already did that. That's what I'm reading from right now.
Oh, I have not known that even came out.
Oh, ER,
yeah.
ER. Is it ER or?
E/ OR, emergency and
yeah.
or operating room.
Well,
I tell you, man, you know what?
That's what I've been reading from.
Yeah,
I'm definitely
gonna have to check that shit out.
Well, here, let me read you a poem from the. This book is broken down into four sections. The first section is the period that led up to my going into the hospital, which was when I was a drunken fool, and it's called Long Beach and 40 Ounces a Day, so you can kind of get the flavor there. And then there's the actual hospitalization poems, which is in the section called Bad Moon Rising, and then there's Business as Usual, which is when I get out of the hospital and have to, like, totally change my lifestyle. And then there's the last section is Minding My P's and Q's, and that's kind of like what it's like to be involved in the county healthcare system.
Excellent, man.
And
I'm
a person who spent most of his life avoiding doctors and hospitals and anything to do with the medical profession pretty vigorously. So this is like, it's very weird being like sort of eyeball deep in the medical system, you know, especially the county medical system, which is not that great. Let's just put it that way. That's the polite version. Let's put it that way. Let me read this poem, and maybe this will be the last poem, you know. I don't know. I don't know where the time frame is, but...
You got time for a couple more?
Okay, well, this is kind of a longer piece, and it kind of sums up the whole... what it's like for me to be involved in the county medical system. So, I should give a little background. I was diagnosed with diabetes in the end of 2008, and the way I was diagnosed was because I had a septic situation in my right leg, where they thought they might have to cut my leg off, you know, at just below the knee, and they put me in a hospital where they proceeded to give me all kinds of treatments and whatnot. And I managed to keep them from cutting my leg off, which was always nice. And,
yeah.
You know, it was a very strange experience. I mean, I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. I'd never been in a hospital that long. And apparently that's pretty long these days. I don't know. I mean, I had no frame of reference, because for me it was like a first time experience, and so it was I kind of approached everything with a sense of wonder, you know, since I just didn't know any better, and it gave me an interesting perspective, I think, apparently from what people told me. So this is after the hospitalization has ended, and you know, I have to go in for checkups every so often so they can monitor and make sure that everything's copacetic in the leg and foot department. Okay. Life Among the Mangled, number one. Every 6 weeks for the last 2 years, I've gone to the hospital for quote-unquote observation for my foot injury. It's an all-day chore, sometimes an ordeal, but mostly it's just a lot of boredom and waiting, punctuated by moments of wonder and or horror. The hospital I go to serves a lot of indigents and poor folks, mostly Spanish-speaking, so the hours pass in a cacophony of words I don't understand. This alone can drive you crazy, but it's just another challenge to be endured. You wait to be admitted, you wait to see the doctor, and since it's a training hospital, it's usually a doctor you've never seen before, and you wait for the doctor in an examination cubicle. While waiting to see the doctor, I work on a crossword puzzle until I start to go mad from boredom and isolation, my isolation being that alone in the crowd type. My fellow patients are usually fairly chipper, chattering away with each other, talking on their cell phones. They all look okay, though some sport corrective shoes or braces or the special casts that I remember quite well, a cast that can be removed, designed to protect the foot or what's left of it. But you can't tell who is missing what, not until you walk down the corridor to your cubicle. And it's then that you see all manner of devastation as you pass half toes, no toes, feet that are no longer look like feet, more like stubs, horrible sights on people you were just listening to out in the waiting room, people who appeared to be normal. I almost feel guilty for possessing my 10 little piggies, even if my right foot has developed a condition known as Charcot, where the bones of the foot begin to spread apart like logs on a raft where the lashings have bailed. And it being a training hospital, fledgling doctors concoct fantastic solutions to the problem, allowing them to practice their skills as surgeons, as healers, as if we're nothing more than lab rats for their education, fodder for the advancement of medicine. One doctor suggests surgery to rebuild and reshape the bones of my foot, slicing and dicing, attaching pins and screws, holding it together. Well, the next one on a later visit says it is stabilized and won't get any worse or any better. Quietly, I'm thinking they won't be happy until they've gotten me on the amputation table down the line. And then I'll be just like my compadres in the waiting room. Maybe my Spanish will improve too. Well, there you go.
I love it.
That's from E/OR, Living Amongst the Mangles, available at fine bookstores near you or www.lumexpress.com.
Absolutely. I think we should just take off the E/OR and just go Living with the Mangles.
I
stock in my fucking bookstore. How about you?
I actually
you
did.
Fucking... Yeah.
Fucking
great fucking poem, man. All right, keep it going, man. You want to drop another one?
Sure. I'm going to go back over here to... do the fabulous Lummix magazine and reads. Read a poem in here by this guy Rain Dog. You know, at some point I realized I was doing this this big huge anthology and I hadn't included my own any of my own poetry in it. I thought, man, that's really being selfless when you put out a magazine and you don't even put your own work in it, you know.
So you can give us a few more and then it's gonna stop. So
all right, okay. Well, this is one of mine. It's called Anniversary. I watched you sleeping after a night of sexual chaos, breathing contentedly, the sounds of the world filtering through the open window along with gray light, with the gray light of dawn. It was the best thing in my life. So right, so unreal. A piece of silk floating on the black lagoon, blown in by the ongoing tornado of this crazy life we call home. I could scarcely move for fear that you would bound away like a startled doe. I didn't know if I should laugh or cry. But then that moment was lost, crushed and absorbed into the hungry maw that was either your insatiable need for validation or the ongoing tornado, I really can't determine which. Now I sit here amid the ruins, another error in the grand scheme of things, another told you so moment, 2 years forward and still spinning.
Nice.
So now we're listening to Wolf Karsten's Home Life. So nice to share that with us. And let me, if I can, if there's time, there's a short poem towards the back here that I've actually been using as part of the PR for the magazine, because I think it really sums it up in a very short frame of time by Rosanna Frechette. It's called Found Art.
Go
spot
for
a diamond bit among crushed beer cans and rusted cars is to find truth in this man-made world.
Nice, man.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, so it was awesome having you on. It's warning me that it's time to go, so I don't want it to
it's time to
drop
go,
you. Didn't want to drop
oh,
you
that's
mid-sentence.
Fine, man. I appreciate it. I appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check out that ER book. I didn't even know it was out. Like,
oh, yeah. It's not up in years.
Yeah,
go to
I
my
got
website.
My head up.
Go to my website.
Maybe,
scroll down.
Maybe you just... maybe last year you just mentioned that the book, that something about the book. That's probably why I thought it was in the makings or something. But anyways, yeah, it was awesome having you on, and I don't know, I'll be checking
Thanks,
that Frank. Stuff out. All right, have a good one.
All right, take care.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.